Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Consumer confidence number at 97. The expectations coming in 66.4. You got to wonder what's behind that.
Yeah, and that expectation 66.4 is down from last month's revised up 74, so a big drop there.
Well, luckily, we have Dana Peterson here. She's chief economist over at the Conference Board. They do this data, so it's great that we get her for that instant reaction. So just to recap, that consumer confidence number coming at 97. Dana, what happened? What's behind that?
Sure. This is the third month that the index has fallen off, and certainly in the month, consumers were less optimistic about current employment conditions, and certainly looking forward, they were less optimistic about employment, business, and also income. But I would say that if you look out over the last 2 years, the headline measure has been moving back and forth in a pretty narrow range. But still, in all 3 months down, we really wonder what's going to happen in that fourth month.
So how long is a trend here? I mean, it feels like a trend to me, and I'm looking at some of the revisions downward here. What is this data really telling us here? Is there a problem for this U.S. economy here?
Well, I would split it out. So the headline is made up of present conditions and also expectations. So the present conditions index has actually stayed pretty much afloat, even though it's moving back and forth a lot. But expectations really came off about a year or so ago, and they've just been flirting with that 80 threshold, and below 80 usually signals a recession. So it suggests consumers are a little worried about something. They're concerned about inflation still, and they're getting a little bit worried about the labor market.
So to that point, this kind of goes to the whole idea that people feel really bad, even though the overall data, like you could look at the employment cost index coming in higher than estimated, you know, GDP, I realize, was a little cool, but still, the data actually comes in pretty strong. How do we understand that?
So I think the key thing is, on the one hand, consumers are working, and so they feel good about that, and they have income coming in, but then that income is eroded by inflation. Prices are still elevated, even though prices aren't rising as quickly as they were. The level is high. People are saying eggs are $8. I'm not used to that, and I don't really like that.
All right, Dana, thanks so much for joining us. Dana Peterson, she's a chief economist at the Conference Board. Kind of break down some of these consumer confidence data coming in today. And again, the headline is Alex just reported. Conference Board consumer confidence came in a reading of 97. The consensus was 104. So a pretty big miss there.
It's straight up inflation.
Inflation.
I mean, like, you're right. If you're going to go pay $8 for eggs, like, that's how you feel.
It doesn't matter
what your paycheck necessarily is.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
And Alex Castillo alongside Paul Sweeney. This is Bloomberg Intelligence Radio. We cover all the top news with our amazing analysts worldwide. They cover about 2,000 companies and 130 industries. We also want to give you the perspective of bigger market strategists, right? Like, how do you look at it if you're looking at the longer-term perspective when it comes to equities, and how the short-term is dictating how you're going to see the outcome? Chris Watling is CEO and Chief Market Strategist over at Longview Economics. He joins us now from Toronto, Canada. So I'm looking, Chris, at an S&P chart of 1 month. And clearly, we had a decline last week, right? We've retraced that. We're up about 3% from the lows, but we're still down by about 2-2.5% from the peak that we saw back in early April. What do I make of the market?
What do you make of the market? What a great question. And morning, Alex and Paul. Great to be on. I think it's time for a bit of give back. I mean, think about it. It's been extremely good run all the way from the sort of lows in October last year through to where we were at the beginning of April when we sort of hit the highs on the S&P. And since then, I think we've had just a bit of give back, a bit of a pause, what I would call a healthy correction. And, you know, part of the reasons for that is I think the market's starting to think about the liquidity environment over the summer. You know, the RRP, this draining of the RRP has been a real driver for stock markets, for risk assets over the last 7-8 months. As that's been drained and liquidity's come into equities, that's been a real positive. And also, I think there's some issues about yields backing up is a bit of a sort of biting on the valuation side of the equity market. And then on top of that, personally, I think growth's going to surprise a little bit to the downside in the States this year. So grappling with all of those, I would say. And as you said, the market bounced last week. It sold off the prior week. You know, markets don't go down in straight lines. They don't go up in straight lines. So I think we've begun early April a bit of a give back, a healthy correction, as I say. And I think it's good for the market. So it's important. And it often happens at a time when you begin some rotation in sector leadership. So that's kind of interesting as well.
Chris, we're about halfway through earnings season here. Anything jumping out at you so far? I mean, I guess revenue is surprising, maybe 1-2% on the upside. Earnings, maybe 8-9% on the upside. Anything surprising you?
Well, I think, I mean, the interesting thing, I mean, somewhat surprising, but somewhat sensible, I suppose. You've got that following wind when earnings have been a bit better. So, as you say, the earnings are surprising to the upside. They are delivering growth. I think the collective surprise is about 8% at the moment, and normally it's 3-4% positive surprise. So that's coming in. I think it's quite interesting how some of the big stocks have been very mixed. We've seen over the last 7 or so days, you know, some of the big cap tech having very different outcomes and very different performance as a result. So there's a lot of volatility on the back of that in some of those stocks, you know, 10% moves on the day on earnings announcements. So I'd say those are probably so far the key features. Lots to go for, lots to come.
So Cameron Kreis writes a daily newsletter. He also contributes to MLive. And he had one of the best sentences I've heard in a while on his daily article today, Chris. He said, one of the basic principles of successfully navigating financial markets is that you should only date, not marry, your positions. Begs the question, what positions should you date and what should you marry right now?
Well, I like to think of it as renting, not owning, rather than dating, rather than marrying.
Okay, but I kind of like the date and marry, but okay, I see your point. Rent versus owning.
Fine. Yeah, it's all the same. What should you date? Well, I think you should be dating, if you're a very short-term trader, you should be short this equity market for a bunch of weeks, a couple of months. And you should be thinking about marrying at the bottom in a month or two's time, because, you know, the soft landing that I think is going to come in the US, coupled with some eventual rate cuts, certainly out of the Fed, but also, of course, out of the European Central Bank and out of the UK. That's all coming. That's all very positive. So, you know, you want to date in the short term and rent in the medium term. Gold we like, and gold you could almost marry. you know, I mean, gold. I mean, gold. Gold is it's a terrific asset class at the moment. It's had a great run already this year. Of course, it's given a bit of that back recently, but it's got a lot going for it. The Chinese are buying. There's some stories, I think, on the Bloomberg terminal today about Chinese buying, central bank buying. That's been a theme all year. And it's not just the central bank in China. It's also the retailer is in China is starting to buy. And there's of course, an awful lot of them and a lot of liquidity around there. So we like gold, and it'll be helped when the Fed eventually starts cutting rates. So I you know, as I say, you could almost marry that. I actually think European banks You should own and rent and buy and everything. I think I actually our left of field recommendation at the moment is buy Spanish mid caps, which is really out there. But
Spanish mid caps.
Yeah, I know. It sounds a bit nuts, but but actually, there's a lot to be said for them. It's an economy that's been neglected. No one's really talked about for 10, 15 years since the euro crisis, of course, the pigs crisis, as it was known, with the S being Spain. And, you know, the economy's really sorted itself out over these last 15 years, healed a lot of structural imbalances. It's well set, and it's going to get rate cuts when the ECB starts cutting. And it's going to benefit from those. And I think we're going to see strong growth out of Spain. And of course, mid-caps is a great way to play a domestic economy. So that is an own and a marry, basically. Not a rent or whatever the other one was. Date, yeah. So there's so much going on. There's so many opportunities out there. But yeah, you've got to distinguish between trading and investing, which
All right,
I think
Let's go hyper-local. How's the economy in Clapham, which is a neighborhood south of London?
Clapham.
How's it going? That's a great question. I do actually live very close to Clapham. I'm obviously in Canada at the moment. But,
that's too bad.
Clapham in south London is buzzing because it's full of 20 and 30-year-olds, basically, who love to get out and the sunshine's starting to come out. And it's that time of year. So, but the British economy is not good.
No.
Which is perhaps more to your question. The British economy is flat. It's had no growth in 2 years. It's flat as a pancake. It desperately needs rate cuts, and we're going to be getting those pretty soon.
Yeah, so is that the expectation that the Bank of England is not waiting on the Fed, that the Bank of England is confident to cut rates sooner?
Absolutely. I think the Bank of England is just like the ECB, and you would have seen Christine Lagarde a couple of weeks ago say, the ECB is not... is data dependent, not Fed dependent, trying to make that distinction between the Fed and the European Central Bank. So same in the UK, different inflation dynamics, different growth dynamics, and therefore a need to get on with cuts.
I wonder what the currencies are going to say about that and the rate differentials. But okay, let's play it out a little bit. How strong does the dollar actually get? It is definitely breaking things.
It is breaking things, and you're quite right. And it's probably got, I think it's got one more flurry in it, in this sort of risk-off phase that we're thinking about in the near term. And of course, the dollar's a classic recipient of liquidity when it's risk-off. But beyond that, I think we're going to get into a dollar bear market. You know, we've had a dollar bull market now for a long time, sort of 10 plus years, depending on your starting point. But a long old dollar bull market, and I think we're due a change in that sort of secular status of the currency. So, yeah, I'd give it a few more weeks of strength in the dollar as we complete this risk-off phase, then as we get closer to Fed rate cuts. Because, I mean, I think really in this risk-off phase that, you know, the market wants to bully the Fed for cuts. You know, we're still doing QT. I mean, this is an extraordinary thing. And I think this will be tough for the stock market with QT ongoing. So, yeah. So I think one more flurry in the dollar.
One more flurry. And real quick, Chris. I mean, are we going to get a rate cut in the U.S. here this year?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
I know the data's so mixed, isn't it? I mean, ECI not so good today. Consumer confidence bad. It's a two-speed economy, and I think that's why the data's so confusing. But I do think the reality is, money is much tighter than it has been. Fiscal stimulus is not as good as it was last year. In fact, quite the reverse. And so I think inflation will dissipate and you'll get a cut. And maybe two, but certainly one.
Hey, Chris, really appreciate it. Chris Watling joining us from Longview Economics. Just side note, Paul, Chris knows this, but you don't.
No.
He is my mom's favorite.
He is?
He is.
Nice.
She has been for a while. He doesn't know what to say to that. I just feel like he used to be on with me in the morning show. We used to jam for like an hour or two. And
okay.
She's Carol Steele's favorite.
Oh.
Putting that out there. It's a big deal. It's a big deal.
That means a lot.
And speaking of the Fed, Bloomberg Radio has full coverage for you starting at 1:30 Eastern tomorrow. Very much, Paul, looking forward to that.
Tom, Lisa, and John Farrell. How good is that?
So good. Can't get any better.
Talking about the Fed. And then you get, and Michael McKee. We're sending him on the Acela train this afternoon. He'll be down there ready to go and ask his question or two of the Fed chairman during the press conference tomorrow afternoon, which starts at 2:30 p.m. Wall Street time.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Paramount. Paramount is the old CBS television network and stations. It's the Viacom, which is MTV and all that kind of good stuff. The Paramount movie and TV studio, all that's wrapped up into this company renamed Paramount. A lot going on there, let's just put it. I mean, they got reported earnings last night, mixed. They replaced their CEO, that's not good, with an office of CEO. And oh yeah, they're actually in discussions to be sold to one or more parties. I'm not sure what's going on there. A lot of moving pieces. Luckily, we have Geetha Ranganathan joining us. She's a media analyst, the media analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. She's based in Princeton, New Jersey. So Geetha, let's start with the potential ownership change here. There's lots of parties looking at Paramount. I guess the Skydance, which is the media company owned by Mr. Ellison, the son of Larry Ellison of, what is that? Where is he from?
Oracle.
Oh, yeah, Oracle. Thank you. So where are we with those negotiations, Geetha?
Yeah, good morning, Paul and Alex. So we're in the thick of those negotiations. There is an exclusive negotiating window that Paramount agreed to with Skydance. That one actually expires this Friday. So obviously the ouster of Bob Bakish, a CEO who was vehemently opposed to the deal, seems to suggest to us that they really have something lined up and something's going to go through pretty quickly.
What did we make of the actual earnings? I mean, I was on air breaking the numbers yesterday, and like we didn't even talk about the numbers. We just talked about the CEO replacement and the weird three CEO thing they got going on. What did we learn within the numbers?
So the actual earnings by itself, Alex, was not bad at all. I mean, there were definitely some encouraging elements. We saw advertising hold up really well. But again, one could argue that core advertising is still challenged. The reason that they reported the 17% increase in advertising revenue in the first quarter was really all driven by the Super Bowl telecast. That said, I mean, you know, if you kind of looked at their streaming business, we did see a pretty good momentum there in terms of subscriber numbers. You know, we did see some progress on profitability, which is not to say that it's actually profitable, just that the losses were a little bit better than what we were expecting. But overall, I mean, this is right now, as Paul kind of pointed out, this is peak uncertainty at Paramount right now. We don't know what's going on with ownership. We don't know what's going on with leadership. We don't know what's going on with strategic direction. So it's all up in the air.
So, Geetha, I guess one of the big questions on any change of ownership is what are they going to pay per share, the buyer, and are they going to pay the same price for Sherry Redstone's controlling shares, the super voting shares? Are they going to pay the same for those shares as they will for the plain old shareholder shares? So how's that work?
Yeah, they're not, Paul. And that's kind of been the whole bone of contention, right? So the whole Skydance proposal is kind of this very convoluted offer. It's this two-step proposal where they basically pay out Sherry. Her interest in Paramount is worth something like about $800, $850 million. They're going to pay her upwards of about $2 billion. So she's getting a nice pocket of change there, but it's basically diluting everybody else. And that's why you have all of this shareholder consternation. Of course, Skydance is kind of addressing that now. You know, they have sweetened the bid a little bit. They've thrown in about a $3 billion cash infusion to pay down debt, to buy back stock. But I'm not sure if that's going to be enough.
Do you feel like this is the best and final offer from Skydance as we get to that Friday deadline?
That's what they have said, yes.
Okay. Did we learn anything from the numbers yesterday that shows what a buyer should be paying for shares?
So we do have another concrete offer on the table, one that Sherry Redstone rejected. This was the offer from Apollo, which basically offered, you know, $12 billion for the equity of the company versus what it's currently trading at, which is about $8 billion. So, you know, roughly about $19 to $20 a share. So that's kind of where, you know, the Apollo deal stands. Of course, now there have been rumors that they're partnering with Sony to, again, take that bid up a little bit. But, you know, when we kind of did a sum of the parts analysis, you know, we think that this company is easily worth, you know, upwards of $20 a share.
Yep. Hmm. I've seen that. So, folks, if you want to check out that research analysis, you can go to BI Go on the terminal and search for Geetha's work. They did a lot of valuation work on Paramount. A lot of investors are looking at that work as well. So, Geetha, Friday is, I guess, one kind of date to keep in mind, but it just seems like with this dual class of stock and maybe different prices being paid for different classes of stock, this thing's going to end up in court. It just feels like, what are most people thinking about this?
I think it definitely, there's a very, very high probability of litigation. I mean, it's not probability, it's almost a certainty at this point. Everybody has said, all the big shareholders, including Mario Gabelli, has said that they will definitely litigate if Sherry Redstone actually goes through with this deal, a deal which does not treat all shareholders equally. And this isn't something new, Paul, with Paramount. I mean, we've seen this litigation stuff happen over and over again. But it definitely is a huge risk, and it's going to be interesting to see what Sony and Apollo kind of come up with in the meantime.
Before I let you go, Warner Brothers Discovery is down like 8%. Why?
Why? Because no NBA. So their NBA rights are actually being negotiated right now. They're currently paying about $1.2 billion. Rumor is that NBC, which is owned by Comcast, is kind of swooping in, ready to pay about $2.5 billion to the NBA and snatching away the rights from TNT. That's where, you know, Warner Brothers owns TNT. That's where they show the NBA games. And remember, NBA, TNT is kind of the anchor to the Warner Brothers TV portfolio, and the NBA is the anchor to the TNT network. So not having that is really going to hurt them. It's hurting them, as you can see in the stock price today.
Speak of turnover and CEOs, how about David Zaslav, the CEO of Warner Brothers Discovery here? I mean, the stock's down 34% this year, down almost 50% over the last year. Holy cow, John Malone cannot be happy with what's going on here. What's the thinking about Warner Brothers Discovery here?
Hard to say, Paul. I mean, the whole story here was supposed to be synergies, which I think they've done a pretty good job on. But what's really kind of been out of their control has been the TV ad market. Which has really, you know, it's of course secularly challenged. And I think what made it even far, far worse was the Hollywood strikes, which just kind of resulted in no good content right now. And so they're kind of trying to work through all that. But, you know, we've chatted before about this. The EBITDA number that they kind of showed everybody was $14 billion. This year, they're going to go below $10 billion. Add to that, you know, about $40 billion in debt. And it's really just a train wreck right now.
I mean, I feel like that is well said, you know. I said hot mess yesterday about Paramount, train wreck, about Warner Brothers Discovery. It kind of sums it up, I think, for
the
us
life
here.
Of a media analyst and media investor these days.
Yeah, it's so crazy.
Tough place to be. Yep.
It is.
It's a tough place to be.
And, you know, we can make hay about Paramount, what I think is 71 million subscribers. Like,
yeah.
Isn't, but then compare that to Netflix?
Right.
Forget it.
A couple hundred million.
Geetha, thanks a lot. We appreciate you. You are the best. Geetha Ranganathan, she joins us. She is head of U.S. media coverage for Bloomberg Intelligence. What's interesting too, I think, Paul, is that when you get to these companies, like the numbers in some ways then matter less.
Yep.
It's more about what the strategy is going to wind up being and who's going to be able to turn it around. Same thing for Warner Brothers Discovery and same thing for Paramount.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been a very big challenge for the industry overall, you know, navigating that transition. Mm-hmm. From the traditional distribution through cable to all this streaming stuff. So we'll have to see how that plays out for both of these companies.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Smack dab in the middle of earnings. And right now we're getting through the tech earnings, and it is a big week here next couple of days. Today after the close, Amazon set the report, and then Thursday after the close, we'll hear from our good friends at Apple. Walk us through what are some of the key issues that we need to focus on, that the market needs to focus on, is Gene Munster. Gene Munster is the managing partner, co-founder of Deepwater Asset Management. He's been covering Silicon Valley for decades. He is absolutely a go-to voice. We appreciate getting a few minutes of his time. Hey, Gene, let's start with Amazon. I guess it's all about the cloud, isn't it?
Indeed, Paul. The cloud AWS is expected to continue to accelerate. So just taking a couple steps back, AWS growth over the past year and a half has been declining from high 20%, and then it bottomed at 12% in the September quarter, bumped up to 13% year-over-year growth in December, and expectations in print are for 15% year-over-year growth in March. I mentioned and emphasized the word print there because the whisper numbers have been stoked after Azure and Google Cloud reported last week. And of course, they had upside to their cloud numbers. I suspect that the whisper number is 16% plus. In other words, if they print a 16% growth up from 13 in December, that may be viewed as a slight disappointment. A couple other just quick, really important parts related to the whole AWS conversation. As a reminder, this is 17% of Amazon's revenue and about 67%, this is for calendar 23, of their earnings. So it punches above its weight when it comes to profitability, and that's why investors are so hyper-focused. And when you put all this together, Paul, what you have is a picture where AWS, with leading market share, continues to lose market share. I mentioned that 16% whisper number. If they deliver on that, they're growing at half the rate that Azure and Google Cloud are growing. So this dynamic will post an improvement undoubtedly in AWS growth, but still the broader picture around the future of AWS, not the future, but the future market share is still in question as Google and Microsoft are really benefiting from how much they've been invested in AI, and that has been powering their cloud business faster than Amazon.
Folks, I've seen this time and time again. When Gene Munster speaks, people take notes. Alex Steele has been writing furiously over here listening to Gene.
It's so true. I'm like, oh, I got to break Amazon after the bell, so let me really pay attention here. So if we go back to the AWS growth, why? Why did we see that decline in growth? And do we expect them at some point to get back up to 20 and then grow from there? Or is it now going to be in some kind of range?
So during that period of, call it high 20s to that 12%, Azure showed some deceleration from mid 30s down to high 20s, Google Cloud from around 30 down to low 20s. And so it was just a kind of a broader corporate pullback in cloud spending, I think had part of it. But I think the other part was this piece around what's going on the model front. And specifically, of course, with Azure, they've got the integration with OpenAI's models, with Google, their own DeepMind, and what they've done with Gemini and building those models into their cloud offerings. And when it comes to Amazon, they do have an offering. It is related to Anthropic. They also host a lot of the kind of open source models like Llama. But I think that that has played into it. So Alex, to put it in a perspective, I think that half of the decline has been that we saw earlier was because of the broader market, corporate spending. And I think half is because I think that their AI strategy, well, it is forward thinking, still lacks some of the punch that Azure and Google Cloud is integrating.
So, Gene, this company has certainly evolved over the years that at least you and I have covered it. How do investors view this company right now? Like, how do they think about the retail business? Do they just kind of put a relatively low multiple on it and kind of really just focus on the cloud?
Tonight it is all about the cloud. I think that is the central takeaway. I think that beyond this, we are seeing an improvement in some of the metrics around the retail business. And this, of course, is the vast majority of their sales. And the profitability is starting to move in the right direction. And part of that is because of how they've improved the logistics. Some of those have been more recently related to AI in terms of the planning. Some of it's just been good old-fashioned algorithms that make their delivery more efficient. But the retail opportunity I see is kind of a changing of the guard in the Amazon story over the next couple of years. I think investors will progressively focus more on that business. I mentioned today almost 70% of Amazon's earnings come from AWS, and I think that number is going to continue to decline going forward because I think the retail business is going to improve, and the substance of the improvement is better efficiency at logistics. Of course, this is real AI. It's not hype. It's real. And second is related to robotics. It's something that they've done, this Kiva acquisition a long time ago. That's the start to it. But they have a profound opportunity in terms of integrating robotics over the next decade into logistics, which would have a positive impact on earnings. So I do think that we will see the baton switch over the next couple of years in terms of the pressure point. We will be talking about AWS, but it won't be the center focus.
All right, so I feel like I'm relatively prepped now.
Nice.
To break those earnings.
Time well spent.
So can you prep us for Apple on Thursday?
For sure. I think Apple is going to be much more exciting in terms of kind of what the investor reaction is going to be, because the setup we have is pretty well known that the business has been slow. The expectations, their guidance was for revenue to be down 5% year over year, and that's generally where analysts are at. The iPhone segment, analysts are expecting it to be down 10%. And if you take a step back over the last few years, it's continued to be flat to downish, the iPhone. In particular, China is a weakness. I just want to call out that's one of the key metrics that investors are going to be focusing on. In September, the China business was down 3%. In December, down 10%. And I believe that it's going to be down, call it around 13 to 15% in the March quarter. So continued softness in China. That's about 20% of Apple's overall revenue. So that's going to be one of the themes. The second theme, of course, is going to be related to when the bottom of the cycle happens. And I think they will give softish guidance for the June quarter. But the stock may actually react positive to that, because once they've got that negative guidance in, then investors can start to look to the back half of the year. Of course, the new iPhone cycle comes. That will probably have some AI branding around it, and that we should start to see some reacceleration. So the irony of this print is the weak March quarter, punky guidance for June might actually kind of mark the bottom. One last piece, of course, I buried the lead related to AI. This, we're going to hear a lot more in the beginning of June at their developer conference. And I think that there is a piece around this on CapEx. Of course, that was a hot topic last week. Apple is yet to talk about CapEx, any big uptake in CapEx. They stand alone amongst big tech. And I think this is going to be a quarter where investors get some medicine when it comes to Apple and how they are going to be spending in CapEx. If, in fact, Apple wants to participate in AI, which it sounds like they want to, it's going to require a significant uptake in CapEx, and that potentially could be at the cost of margins, a couple percent in margins. So that's the piece I'm bracing for, is what their commentary on CapEx is related to generative AI.
Are you surprised, Gene, that we haven't seen a more aggressive move on AI from Apple?
Absolutely. I mean, their silence to date, it's more recently, it's they've said more, but has been deafening, at least in 2023. And I think that they've got a golden opportunity here. They have a brand around privacy. The current stage of AI that we're operating in is generative AI, where we prompt a model, it gets back, we can have a conversation. The next phase, and this is, it won't be products today with Apple, but I think ultimately where they're going to go is what's referred to as agentic or agent or personalized AI. You'll hear those terms interchanged. But this is the idea of AI actually completing a task for you instead of just responding in part to a conversation. And again, because I think what Apple does around privacy, I think they're going to have an invitation for consumers really to build some unique products around agentic AI down the road.
All right, Gene, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Gene Munster, managing partner, co-founder of Deepwater Asset Management. Give us a preview here for Amazon tonight after the close and Apple reporting their results Thursday after the close.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business App. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm Alex Steele. Here alongside Paul Sweeney, we are live from Interactive Broker Studio right here in Midtown Manhattan. This is Bloomberg Intelligence Radio. We cover all the news for you, all the top news for you with our amazing analysts worldwide. They cover about 2,000 companies and 130 industries. So let's get to one of them right now. Look at McDonald's stock, doing a whole lot of nothing. It was down earlier today. It has slight miss on earnings per share and their comp sales, particularly international, missed estimates. But the big news everyone seems so excited about is this biggest burger thing. They're going to test it to try and spark some traffic growth.
Test it right here. Let's bring it.
I mean, okay. Just buy two of them. Anyway, let's get more details on this with Michael Halen. He is a Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Restaurant and Food Service Analyst, and he joins us now. Okay, let's just kiss off the earnings before we get to this big burger thing. What was your biggest takeaway?
I'd say the biggest takeaway was, you know, the fact that April's flat so far in the United States. That's trailing the industry level, you know, the industry data that we get. So, and also, you know, restaurant brands reported this morning, and Burger King showed an acceleration in the U.S. in their U.S. numbers. So I would say that was the biggest surprise. You know, McDonald's still on a 5-year trend is vastly outperforming Burger King and most of the other quick service names. But there seems to be some slowing. If I was to guess, some of that bad press around the $18 Big Mac meal in some markets, you know, could be hurting, because we are seeing U.S. consumers really push back against price increases right now, and they're being more picky about where they spend their money.
Mike, I see just in the Bloomberg reporting here, executives have also said that low-income consumers in the U.S., which is an important part of the company's customer base, are pulling back. Does that mean we're going to see more promotions, which might be put pressure on the margins?
Yeah, we see. McDonald's has come out and said they're going to focus more on their value menu. They're going to continue to offer promotions, a lot of them through the apps. So it looks like a full-on value war is here. I mean, Burger King said they're going to be a little bit more careful than they've been in the past with their price increases, because, you know, they've had some increases over the last 5 years or so. Burger King's going to be a little bit more careful with their discounting because in the last 5 years or so, they've gotten too aggressive and it hurt franchisee margins. So they kind of poo-pooed that a little bit. But we think a full-blown value war is here and it's on the table for 2024.
So does the value war take into account a bigger burger? Is that the deal?
Well, value, you know, it's measured in a couple ways. It's not just the price, but it's what you get for the price. Right. And so, you know, I'm sure McDonald's has done their legwork, and they have some customer feedback that says that they want some bigger burgers on their menu. And so that's going to be interesting. They said they're going to start testing it in the second half of this year. So it may not hit the United States for quite some time.
Sorry.
But yeah, there's a couple of ways to measure value.
Hey, Mike, what are the McDonald's of the world and, you know, the other restaurant companies you talk to, what are they saying about these GLP-1 drugs? Are they really going to impact their business?
You know, I don't think there's too much worry about that anymore. I know that was a big thing last summer and into the fall, and it really impacted the prices of some of these quick service restaurant chain stocks, especially McDonald's. But, you know, I've seen a lot of different reports out there, and you know, the amount of people on these drugs ranges from, you know, 7 to 12 or maybe 15% best case if mm-hmm. Once they get to like maybe a pill form instead of a shot. You know, and we don't know about long-term side effects from some of these drugs. So I think initially there was some concern, but over time, McDonald's and these other chains, they're going to figure out how to make a 7 to 12% smaller cheeseburger, right? They're getting smaller anyway because beef prices are going, they're going up. And, you know, there's a historical situation in the cattle market right now. And so beef prices are going to continue to stay elevated in here for a couple of years. And so chains are already starting to try to, you know, solve for some of these problems, you know, ahead of broader adoption.
Yeah, I mean, you have to think that shrinkflation is going to hit in many different ways. Yeah. But before we let you go, we have about a minute left. So who wins the value war right now based on what you've seen?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, McDonald's historically has. And so that's what's most interesting about them underperforming in April. Burger King is an interesting one because, you know, they have easier comps. They struggled coming out of the pandemic for a few years, right? And so they have easier comparisons to lap lower average unit volumes at the store level. And so there's room for some upside there. Chipotle absolutely continues to knock the cover off the ball. And, you know, McDonald's has scale, right? And so when they really start pushing on value, everyone else is going to feel it. So you know, I'm confident that McDonald's can kind of turn the tide here a little bit because they can just offer burgers and other items at prices their competitors yep. just can't match.
All right, Michael. Great stuff as always. Mike Halen, he's a senior restaurant and food service analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. McDonald's putting out some numbers a little bit disappointing. The stock kind of flat here today. Talking about just kind of where the demand is or where some of their customers are facing some pressure. So how promotional do you need to be and how innovative mm-hmm. do you need to be in products? You know, I don't know.
You just heard what he said, right? Yeah. I mean, he likes Chipotle.
I get the same thing today that I got when I was like 15.
Which is?
A number two with a Coke. It's like a quarter pounder or something with cheese.
Okay. Can you offer the price for that?
Like, I don't know. I don't even know. No, but I'm sure the price has gone up dramatically. So, but we'll have to see. But it still works. But I only do it once or twice a year. So who cares?
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.